I'm Rick Dedarian, and this is Realms of Memory. The Diary of Anne Frank has sold over 20 million copies and been published in over 60 languages. It's inspired everything from graphic novels and Japanese anime to movies and off-Broadway musicals. The secret annex in Amsterdam, where the Frank family spent nearly 2 years in hiding from the Nazis, now draws over a million visitors a year. Dutch historian David Barnow, who co-authored the critical edition of the diaries, has described the seemingly endless interest in and uses of the memory of Anne Frank as the Anne Frank industry. The world's leading authority on the diaries, Barnow explains the reasons for the rise to global prominence of Anne Frank in his book, The Phenomenon of Anne Frank. A conversation with David Barnow about the phenomenon of Anne Frank in this episode of Realms of Memory. David, welcome to Realms of Memory.
Nice to be here.
So I wanted to start just by trying to give listeners a sense of what do you mean by phenomenon? To what extent has Anne Frank, the diary, the person, become a phenomenon? How would you explain that?
One of the main points with Anne Frank is when she was writing a diary, she was young and she hadn't complete filled ideas about everything. She was looking, like when you're young, you're looking at different things. And when you're 40 or 50, you know what it is, how the world is, and what you think, etc. So because her what she writes down is so open that everybody can find something in it. And that's for people who believe in God, people who don't believe in God, people who are only interested in how a young girl is growing up, people who are interested in what is the start of the Holocaust. And it doesn't matter what kind of country you're coming from. She's international. How she became? You say it's very very fast, but in the beginning, it wasn't like that. Of course, her father had big problems to find a publisher, and I can imagine why, because nobody had ever heard of Anne Frank. And a diary written by a young girl, they were never published. So publisher number 6 or 7 or 8 said, okay, let's try it. And even then, it wasn't a big success in the beginning. But Otto Frank has been very active in promoting his daughters. Even when the first print wasn't out of print, he urged the publisher house to make a second printing and a third printing, etc. And he was trying to get translations in foreign languages, etc., etc. Without the activity of her father, the book would never have been published the first time. He was the only survivor of this family in the Netherlands, and it was the voice of his daughter he wanted to send into the world, starting in the Netherlands.
Okay, so in part, it's the open-ended, it's the fact that this is written by a young girl. She doesn't have strong, adult formulated opinions that might alienate readers. It's something that can be broadly interpreted by different types of readers in different places. And also her father works tirelessly to find a publisher, to find translators. And what you stress a number of times in your book is that he's flexible. He's not rigid in his demands. To some extent, he is a little bit, but he's willing to make compromises. And he also makes some changes that makes the diary a little more accessible. So how much credit do we give to Otto?
He's a businessman. He is not a man of letters. It was for him first time doing this like that, and by dealing with the publisher, I think he was dealing as a businessman. He wasn't. I want to print every letter of Anne Frank. No. So okay, if you don't want that, then we do that. So it's not easy going. It's more like what business people are used to. Take something and you get something.
But originally he tests out the book on acquaintances. He tests out the diary, and you mentioned, and this is not widely known, that there are two separate diaries, and he tests out diary one on readers, and there seems to be a strong interest, but that's not eventually what makes it into the final version.
No, it was not testing out. It was more that people who knew him asked after the war, he survived Auschwitz, they asked him, how did you do that, living in hiding with your family for 2 years? And then he thought, yeah, I can tell them, but my daughter had written it down. So he copied her diary, in this case her first version, and gave it to people, and they were interested. And some of them said, oh, you have to have it printed. That's what a lot of people are telling you when you give them a chapter or something. And then he thought, yeah, but it's not the only part. Because Anne Frank started to rewrite her diary half a year, more than half a year before they were arrested by the Germans. She started to rewrite her diary because on the radio, the Dutch Minister of Education, Dutch Secretary of Education, living in London, where the Dutch cabinet in exile was, he was on the air, and he explained that after the war, they wanted to have an institute where they would collect written stuff or spoken stuff from the occupation by the Germans. And that triggered in Anne Frank, oh, they want my diary. And then they said, yeah, my diary, I have to rewrite it, because in the beginning it's quite childish. And then she started to rewrite it. And she skipped a lot of what you now think it's childish, because, it must be a book. She had no idea, of course, about archives or things like that. So, I have to write a book. So she started to rewrite, change things, copy some things, say 60% is the same as the first diary. And Otto Frank had, of course, a problem. He had now two diaries in his hand. And a publisher house would say, we're not going to publish two diaries with the same content. So he started to make a third diary from it. And that was what he sent to the different publishing houses, a mix from diary one and diary two.
So he has to make some editorial choices as he combines the two diaries, right? And you mentioned in the book that the rewrite, Anne's rewrite, doesn't have the last months. So he's got to go back to the original diary to include that. But he also has to make some decisions on things that he doesn't think are helpful, or things that might offend. And so how much does he leave out?
When you look at the complete diary, it's not so much. But for instance, Anne was very critical on the Germans. And Otto thought, but there are Germans, friends of us, relatives of us, who are German Jews who are killed. So he skipped some of the anti-German stuff. I can imagine. And people are saying, Otto Frank skipped all the things which were critical on her mother. But when you read a diary, what you could get in the bookshop, there are a lot of critical remarks on her mother. It was not Otto Frank who skipped them only. It was also the publishing house. It's quite normal that editors in a publishing house are editing too. I mean, that's their job. And for a first writer, and Anne Frank was a young writer, a new novel, they edit more than they do with a famous writer. And to show that Otto wanted more than a publishing house is a very interesting part when you compare the English translation with the Dutch original. In the English version is 3 or 4 or 5 lines that Anne Frank at a sleepover when she's 9 or 8 And she asked her girl then, shall we see or touch each other's breast? That was skipped in the Dutch version. Nobody would know that that had been. And then you saw it in the English version. So we went to the translator and we asked her what had happened. How could she know this version? And it was very good. She had an archive. I love people who keep their own archives. And she had a letter from Otto Frank. And the letter said, dear Miss Moyard, I've heard from the publisher you almost finished your translation. Here are some lines which were skipped in the Dutch version, but those are lines from Anne Frank, and I want you to put them in the English version. So the English readers always had more Anne Frank than the Dutch original readers. And that shows that Otto Frank was okay with the Dutch publisher because he wanted to publish his book. And at that moment, the Netherlands was quite Calvinist country, not the country of sex, drugs, and rock and roll, what people always thinking about the Netherlands. But in the early 50s, it was, or late 40s from the last century, it was not like that. But in England, they were more openly minded, so they published that party.
In my sense, too, that he was willing to work with translators, too. I thought that was partly the German translator, too, made some changes, and he was willing to go along with that.
Yeah, everything for publishing the book. And the German translator had two problems. She was quite old. It's not that you cannot translate when you're old, but translating a young girl language is very difficult when you're old. You even have it now when you try to translate street language from younger people, it's very difficult. And secondly, she had an idea, and maybe she was right, if you want to publish a book in Germany with a lot of anti-German slogans, that will not sell. And Otto Frank wanted to sell his book, so he was okay with that also. And that means that that you see a lot of differences in the German translation, and you can see those are political changes.
So the book is getting good reviews. To me, that seems to be a key part of the original momentum, that you're getting runs of a few thousand copies. You're not in the tens of thousands. That
no,
takes time.
Absolutely not. But even good reviews are good if a writer writes a second novel. But this was just this novel, not more. There was also a book published with kind of fairy tales she has invented, but that was not a hit, and those fairy tales are quite clumsy written, so to say. It was modest, not even a hit in the Netherlands, and the interest in the Second World War, in the remembrance of the Second World War, faded away already in 47. It's very, very strange. It's 2 years after liberation. But people were rebuilding, and the official idea was, we have to rebuild and don't look back. And secondly, the Netherlands were involved in two colonial wars to keep Indonesia as a colony. So the past was the past, and okay, we have this book about this young girl, it's very interesting, etc., etc., but that's it. It started after translations. And after an English translation, a play in the United States. And after the play, a movie. What wasn't so successful, but the play was very, very successful. And a play is, of course, never the same like a book. And a movie is not, I mean, they're completely different things. And in this case, you can compare very well the play with the original. And there you can also see that a lot of things were changed for an American audience. It was hardly, you could hardly see that the people were Jewish in the original American play. Not to alienate the non-Jewish audience in the United States. And for instance, they had one song at Chanukah, a Jewish fest in in the book, and they were discussing, yeah, they want to sing it in the play, but not in Hebrew. They sing it in English. Otherwise, the people would say, what are they singing there? So, and Frank, yeah, was more a very lively young American teenager who had difficulties with her mother, yeah, like every girl who's a teenager. And they were in hiding. And yeah, but it was not quite, you hardly could see why they were in hiding. She's a nice, lovely American teenager. And this play was an enormous hit in the United States. And it won the Pulitzer Prize. And the Pulitzer Prize winner would always go the next spring to the Spring Theatre Festival in Paris. And their politic is coming around the corner again. State Department in Washington warned against showing the play because the State Department was very active in trying to get Germany, Western Germany, into NATO and become friends with each other. And they were afraid that showing a play about the Second World War and about hunting Jews would not be good for the relations. So there you can see that a quite innocent young girl and a play becomes part of a political play.
So if you go back to the theme of the memory theme of the podcast, that the book really comes out at the worst of possible times in the Netherlands. Nobody really wants to remember World War II. They're in recovery mode. They're caught up in a brutal war of decolonization in Indonesia, what becomes Indonesia. And then if it does eventually gain momentum, the play in the U.S. has a lot to do with stripping away Holocaust memory. I guess what I wasn't sure of reading through your book, not having, having read the original version one and version two of the diary, how Jewish was it? How ethnically specific was it? How much was taken out of it? Or was it a universal story from the get-go, or did it just become that later on?
First, of course, they were Jews. Otherwise, they wouldn't go into hiding. But they were not religious Jews. They were they came from Germany. They were very in the emancipation of Jews in Germany. When they went to synagogue, it was on the high days, so to say, not every day or every week. And it is a very nice part where you see how it is. We have Otto Frank suggested to give Anne Frank for St. Christmas a New Testament. And it is Margot, the older sister, who said, you cannot give a New Testament. We are Jews. There you see how the father, who is the main character and a very important man, is hardly any Jewish. And so there was discussion about, of course, about when the theater play was, they put it wasn't Jewish enough anymore. You can say, yeah, but they were not strictly religious Jews in that sense. It depends how you look at Jewishness, of course. And in the 50s, early 50s in the United States, Jews living there considered themselves first as American citizen, and secondly as American citizen, and only thirdly as Jews. So that changed over the decades. But that time you keep, let's say, a low profile, even after the Holocaust.
And what I thought was interesting, on the one hand, the play is a huge success because it's not tied into one specific group. It's a story that people can relate to across cultures. And you also stress which is hard to understand. It's a partly a Holocaust story, but it's one with a happy ending? I mean, how does it work out? It's one that doesn't end up depressing the audience.
No.
At a time, you said, where even in the U.S., there wasn't a strong demand for interest in the Holocaust when the play came out.
And it's strange, it comes out during a period just after the Second World War. Partly, there's a very big optimistic view about the new world. The good guys have won. We have United Nations. We think about the future is good. On the other hand, people are very afraid of a Third World War, and that collapsed a little bit. But this play ends very, not happy. Yeah, it ends with voiceover. I believe in the good of humanity. Now then, you go home. Wow, I believe too in the good of humanity, and it looks like Anne Frank ended her diary with that. But of course, that would be very, very. It's 5 or 6 pages before the end. And you can take a lot of quotations from the diary, but taking this quotation out of it, you can go home without any guilt or feeling of guilt, and that had to do also with the book. It's not. You can say it's about the Holocaust, but there is no blood on the pages. It's about the Holocaust, the start of the Holocaust. There is only one small part where she has dreams about one of her friends in a concentration camp, but that's really a dream. It's not reality.
So what's interesting is that on the one hand, if the Holocaust gets taken out, or the what little Jewish specificity there was in gets taken out of the play, maybe the book too, you seem to suggest that if the movie is a flop, the movie doesn't generate a big viewership, maybe it's tied into too much of a specific history, a specific time, specific struggle. And I recognize this was something that you didn't, you really haven't had time to delve into too much, but you suggest that there were certain personalities that were associated with at least the premiere of the film, and they could have heard it.
Yeah. The movie, when you see the trailers of the movie, it's about a young girl with her first kiss. It's not about those people are going to be killed because they are Jews. No. And at the first night in New York, I think, there's a very interesting photo with Martin Luther King, Harry Belafonte, the woman who plays Miss Van Daan, who was seen as a communist, and Otto Frank. In my view, this photo would have a warning for people living, white people living in the South of America, don't go to that movie. I mean, with those black people and the communists, that cannot be a real interesting movie. And in the Netherlands, it was seen, and I remember that I saw it at school when I was 12 or 13. We found it very, very Hollywood. Nothing to do with the Netherlands and the occupation of the Netherlands. And maybe it was too early. After the 60s, hundreds and hundreds of films about the Second World War, also about Holocaust, has been made. But I think this was too early. And when you see it again, it's the play gives more than the movie. In going to the essence of her diary,
you have this character that is a character that a lot of people don't know about, and it's really, on the one hand, I read your book and I thought, oh, this is just somebody who's fighting to get his version of the play out, and he ends up in conflict in court with Otto Frank. But then when I went back over your book, I started to think, well, no, this is also somebody that deserves a lot of credit for maybe the success of the Anne Frank story, and he's part of the Anne Frank phenomenon. And you point out that even before the play is made, and maybe one of the reasons why the play was made, was that Meyer Levin is really pushing to get this translated into English. He's pushing for reviews, and maybe this review in the New York Times Book Review, he might have something to do with that, and that really generates a lot of interest in it. So who is Meyer Levin? How much credit does he deserve for the Anne Frank phenomenon? And you know, what? Why does he end up having a falling out with Otto Frank?
He looks a little bit like Otto Frank with his pushing and pushing for the diary. He was not the only one who was successful in translating in the translation rights for United States, but he was active in it, and he did write his very positive reviews. He made also a radio play from it, and he was convinced that a play had to be made from it, and it was pushing Otto Frank, and he said, I can do it. And Meyer Levin has been a war correspondent from, he came from, I think, the poor Jewish East Side in New York. And he, after the war, he went with the American troops into Germany. So he had seen the concentration camps, and that has influenced his life. And he has written about Jews in America, Jews on the run, so to say. And in this case, now I have a very, very good subject. I'm writing a theater play about it. And Otto Frank, who didn't know anything about plays or how to write it or whatever, but he knew you need a producer. Only a play on paper isn't enough. So I said to Meyer Levin, okay, go on, write it, and if you find a producer who produces it, you have my okay. But he couldn't find any producer to produce his version. And he became angrier and angrier. And Otto Frank, who now had idea, okay, I want to play, became also now you have to stop, because we have this agreement. If you cannot find at one moment an agreement that my 11 had to find 13 or 15 producers, could have them. And if one of them said okay, Otto Frank would say okay too. He couldn't find one. And then the problems became angrier, because he was angry that his version, he said, it's too Jewish. And all those producers and all the people around him are against me, because I'm a poor poor little East Jew, and those other are German Jews, highly educated, etc., and they suppressing my views. His view, it was more more Jewish, and that's I can imagine, but it was also very Zionist. And you can say that, yeah, Anne Frank was a Jew, yes, but a Zionist, no. As when she was young, she went to Zionist youth club, but it was more to go to a youth club. If she were doing other things, she would have gone too. And in her diary, she writes one when they are discussing all the people in hiding. What are you going to do when we're out of this hiding place? And her sister says, "Oh, I'm going to I will be a nurse in Palestine." I said, no, I go to Paris, have fun, dancing, etc. So that's not very Zionist thing. And in the end, two other playwrights wrote a play, the producer was found, and the play was a very big success. But my 11, I also think that because the play was a success, he became angrier. He started to write letters to editors in newspapers. He discusses his synagogues around the United States, complaining he was suppressed by, etc., etc. So that became that's became part of his life. And at one time he succeeded to have it produced on stage in Israel. by the in Tel Aviv, I think. But the lawyers in the United States find out immediately, and they got a big letter from stop with this nonsense, or otherwise you have to pay a big fine, etc., etc., etc. It's tragic, but it shows how important Anne Frank was in this case on one man. They never met each other, but and he wrote also a book with a very good title, My Obsession with Anne Frank.
But my sense is, in the end, it's the play that overshadows the book. And you make this point that the image of Anne Frank is really shaped in the end more by the play than the book.
Yeah. And then the play went to Europe and was an enormous success everywhere. And I always say that Anne Frank was abducted by American playwrights and then sent back as a joyful American teenager. In the 90s, the Anne Frank Foundation, who had the copyrights on the play, made a new adaptation of the play, and they skipped those very positive, I believe in the best of people, and now the play ends with the fate of the people who were killed in Auschwitz or the Bergen-Belsen. So it's now more accurate and more historical accurate.
But if the play, to use the contemporary term, going viral, if the book or if the Anne Frank story becomes something global, becomes a phenomenon, you got to give the credit to the play. And if you get these massive prints, right, you're talking about in the thousands. When it first comes out in 1947, you get several reprints, but it's in the thousands. And then eventually it's the U.S. market after the play. They start to generate some serious runs of the book, and then it gets into other countries. I thought it was interesting because my wife happens to be Japanese. She's has a very strong memory of the Anne Frank story, and she was really pushing for us when we went to Amsterdam to go and visit the Anne Frank house. And you mentioned that it really has a big following in Japan, some huge runs there.
But Japan is very interesting. They have different versions of the diary, and those are political differences. They have one translation, what's more 100% translation. They have one translation where the emphasis is more, we are victims too, we Japanese, because we had two atom bombs. And there is another, also a very nationalistic translation. So it's very sad. There was a scholar here in Rotterdam who found it out years ago. People don't look at different translations, but she did, and came with this very interesting outcome. So when people say, the Japanese say, I've read the diary, I never know what version they have had in their house.
So some of it is just perfect timing. The Japanese are just going through the Second World War, the experience of bombing. I had an episode I talked to a scholar about peace memorial museums in Japan that get built during the 1970s when the U.S. is at war with Vietnam, and it just recalls all these memories of bombing during the Second World War and gets these museums off the ground, which are really museums that are all about the experience of victimization during the war in cities that were bombed. The Anne Frank story is connecting in the same way, resonating with a Japanese audience.
Yeah, and that shows that you can use Anne Frank for everything. During the Balkan War, there was a girl who was writing a diary, and she was immediately baptized as the Anne Frank from the Balkan. So every young girl who writes a diary and it's published and it's in wartime, she's then an Anne Frank. So she's taken out of this context of Holocaust and being Jewish.
So what I thought was interesting is that there's a struggle over ownership of Anne Frank. And there are different poles of authority. And the institute where you spent your career was one kind of pole of authority. It comes in at a later date. But there are these, there's a foundation in Switzerland. There's the Anne Frank House in Amsterdam, and they do not get along. So I thought that was fascinating. How is it that you have these conflicts over that legacy?
It is very fascinating, and friends and colleagues of mine are always very angry that those people are struggling about a young girl. And then I say, follow the money. It has to do with big money. But there is an Anne Frank Stichting in Amsterdam, or Stichting Beans Foundation. They own the Anne Frank House, but that's all they have. And it was founded partly by Otto Frank and other people. Otto Frank went to Switzerland after the war and in the early 50s because his only relatives who were still alive were living there. And there he founded the Anne Frank Foundation for tax reasons, because a lot of money was coming in, of course, from the copyright. And until the 90s of last century, the Anne Frank Foundation in Basel, people had never heard about it. And they were only collecting money and giving it away to good causes. That was all they were doing. And when people were talking about Anne Frank or asking things, then Otto Frank explains the thoughts of his daughter. And nobody questioned that, of course. He is the father, so he knows best. 1980 is a very important time. Otto Frank died, and the Anne Frank House in Amsterdam thought, of course, that they would get the diaries. They had already some diaries, but they were on loan. You could see them there in the glass, etc. But Otto Frank bequeathed all the diaries, also the ones who were on loan, to my institute, which was a state-owned or state-financed institute. And the Anne Frank House was very angry, of course. And it had two reasons, I think, because Otto Frank didn't explain it. Firstly, he didn't know how long the Anne Frank House would survive. It could go bankrupt or whatever. And what would happen to the diaries of his daughter? And secondly, in the 60s and the 70s, the staff of the Anne Frank House had been very active, liberal left, so to say. They were more interested in having exhibition about apartheid in South Africa than about the history of anti-Semitism. And Otto Frank, I mean, he had been a Prussian officer in the First World War. So he's partly liberal, and partly he found all this political stuff a little bit nonsense. And my institute was a state institute, so he thought they don't go bankrupt, so they will not sell the diary. So it came to us. And the last decade that Otto Frank was alive, and the years after he would die, it was the Anne Frank Stichting where people came to ask questions about Anne. But when my institute got involved, and I got involved in making the scholarly edition, the diaries of Anne Frank, I became an expert too. In competition with the Anne Frank House. And during that time, the Anne Frank Foundation in Basel became also more active. They also wanted to be part of this who owns Anne Frank. So I had a very strange triangle, the two, one state institute where I was working, one private institution in Amsterdam, and a private institution in Switzerland. And they were all, my institute was not involved in the money side because we had the diaries, but not the copyright. So we couldn't make money from it, so to say. But the two from the two foundation has seen each other in court 5, 6, 7 times. So solicitors have got a lot of money about this conflict.
Is it fair to say that it's the foundation in Switzerland that gets the lion's share of the money, and that it really benefits from the play, the international notoriety?
Yeah, but that's for sure. I mean, the Anne Frank House had the money from people who are coming and subsidized things, but Otto Frank put all his incomes and copyrights, etc., in the foundation in Basel. And they sometimes, and the last time when they put money into the house in Amsterdam, they also said, "Yeah, we'll also have something to say about the content." And in Amsterdam, they didn't like that.
And when the Anne Frank House starts to get off the ground, they're really scraping and scrapping for money. You mentioned that the mayor of Amsterdam tries to make a plea for support, but the foundation is not very generous in supporting that effort. So I thought that was interesting. It really takes a lot of time for that house to get going.
In the foundation was not very interested in the house because they had the copyright money. That was it. And with or without a house, it didn't matter. And in Amsterdam, you could see that a few hundred people were interested every year to go to the house. It was not a real museum. But there was a moment that people said, we have to circle it down and a modern building would be there. And that's partly also in the time that a lot of Amsterdam, of the old part of Amsterdam, was vanishing away, and new buildings were built. And there was a time that people said, now we have to stop it. I mean, we have a marvelous city with old buildings, and we don't want to become a modern city with only concrete blocks. So that together with the Second World War, But you can also say in the beginning, when the house became a museum, not many Dutch people visited the museum. It were mostly Americans because of the play and the movie. And that stayed a very, very, very long time. And Frank House was for tourists. Had been the idea for almost 50 years. And most of the tourists were American tourists. And it's only since 30 years that Dutch tourists are coming too.
So here I'd like to tap into your split career. Because on the one hand, you're an expert on Anne Frank. And on the other hand, you've devoted a lot of your scholarship to World War II, the occupation, collaboration in particular. So if you're like me and you go on a trip to Amsterdam and you're fortunate, you get tickets, you see the Anne Frank House, you take an Anne Frank tour of Amsterdam, you walk away. I remember I was in the bookstore and I was trying to ask, well, are there any histories of the history of the Anne Frank House and how this comes into being? It was just lots of different versions of the diary. I bought one book that is behind me on my shelf that was on the house, but very little on the history of the house itself. But if you're interested in the Dutch connection, and you know, to what extent do the Dutch relate to this past? And if you go there, you see, you recognize the demand to get into the Anne Frank House and the significance of these tours, and you think, well, this is a center of Holocaust memory. And in your book, at several points, you said, well, one of the things that if people identified in Netherlands with the Anne Frank story, if they saw it as their own, if they laid claim to it, if they were concerned, they didn't want it to become an American Hollywood production, that they had, it was their Anne Frank. It was something that it could make the people in the Netherlands feel good about themselves. I don't know whether this is this happy ending that it had, or the story of protecting this Jewish family. But definitely when you go in to the Anne Frank house. It's the logistics. It's the effort that was made. People that put themselves on the line to protect this family. The fact that they were able to be in hiding for 2 years. When I took the tour, we started off at the Jewish Museum. Then we went to the dock workers monument. And the point was made was that there was this uprising in 1941. There was a protest against these anti-Semitic Nazi occupation policies, and it was brutally crushed. And that this was something that you really put your life on the line if you were going to take a stand against it. And it was, I left that tour and experience kind of with the impression, well, the Dutch people are really doing their part, risking their lives to protect the Jewish community, and that there is this liberal, tolerant tradition, and what the Germans were doing was completely at odds with that, and that there was an effort to react against it. I was crushed, and then listening to your, especially some of your past presentations, I couldn't help really focusing in on comments that maybe it wasn't that much of a risk to protect Jews. And you think you told a story about a farmer who on a couple different occasions, he had significant numbers, and I think he ended up in a camp, but he wasn't lined up in a firing squad. How risky was it to put your protect Jews, to put yourself on the line? How much was that a post-war remembering? How much of the Anne Frank story, if you're trying to understand what happened in the Netherlands during the Holocaust, might give you a very different impression of what actually went on?
I've given a few hundred lectures in the United States about Anne Frank, and I always explain how many Jews were arrested and killed in the Netherlands compared with France and even Germany and Belgium. We have the highest percentage. And the first time people were protesting against it, they didn't believe it. No, it's not true. And I say, well, why don't you believe me? I am the expert, I think, and not you. But they all were helping Anne Frank, all those people. And I say, yes. But we do think she was betrayed too. And then people fell a little bit silent. They realized there are two sides, helping and betraying. And if all the Dutch people would have helped all the Jews, we didn't have the highest percentage. And before the war and even after the war, the Netherlands was seen as a very Jew-friendly country, contrary to France, who were anti-Semitic. Anti-Semites were very important around centuries. But when you see the figures of people who were killed, you could better be in anti-Semite France during wartime than in Jew-friendly Netherlands. Your question about was it dangerous to help Jews? You can say that mostly after the war, people who didn't help Jews told each other, yes, I didn't do it, otherwise they would shoot me. Of course, there were people who were executed, but not that they for hiding a Jew. They were executed because they were running an organization, were helping Jews, were collecting arms, etc. But just for helping Jews, you could always say, oh, I didn't know those were Jews or whatever. And the Germans always claimed that everything you did against the Germans, there were heavy penalties on it. But people realized also that the Germans didn't shoot every citizen who, didn't obey any order. So, the idea that you would be executed if you were helping Jews, that's nonsense. You can see it at the people who were helping Anne Frank. The two women were scot-free. Two others were sent to a Dutch prison camp, and one of them escaped, and the other got out with a a letter from a doctor that he was his health was not good enough to stay in a camp. So you can see the Germans were not that revengeful. No, you can say that there are other reasons why so many Jews were killed in the Netherlands. And yeah, if more and more people had helped Jews, then the Germans would have been stricter. But the organization and the deportation of the Jews went so smoothly. They didn't mind if a few people went underground. They could catch them later. Why should you put all your efforts in getting a few hidden Jews when you got them via the so-called official roundup?
And I think at one point in your book, you point out this dock worker statue, and I'm hoping you can talk a little bit about this uprising. And you can say the Anne Frank story kind of becomes like that. It's something you'd rather remember. You'd rather remember this uprising effort to take a stand against German intolerance, and the Anne Frank story is a good memory as well. Maybe it helps forget the fact that, in my sense, if more Jews were deported, something like 75% of the Jewish population from the Netherlands perishes during World War II. It's the Dutch civil service. Maybe that's very much like the French case, that they kept the records, they shared those records. I don't know whether the Dutch police are involved in helping round or people up or guard people as happened in France. But if you're remembering resistance, if you're remembering uprisings, if you're remembering the Anne Frank story sheltering this family, that's a lot preferable to remembering the darker side of that past.
Of course, just after the war, you're of course only writing and talking about resistance and the people who perished in the camps because they had resisted, because you were very proud of your resistance. It takes some time before people realize that, okay, there was a resistance, but the poor Jews didn't stay in the Netherlands. So what did this resistance do? We had an uprising in Amsterdam in February 1941. It was partly an uprising for Jews, but also for better working conditions in working camps where people who were out of jobs were sent to work there. And non-Jews, so it was partly in economic views, and partly, and that was the most important thing, to show the Germans that the Jews were Dutch, and not aliens, not strange enemies. So and that had been important, although outside Amsterdam, people didn't know about this uprising because of the censorship, of course, and it was suppressed with more than 20 people killed. People sometimes say yes, and then the resistance became bigger and bigger because we had this famous uprising. It's not true. What Germans realized, we have to do our hunting of Jews on a more quiet way, not in the open, and with less shouting and police dogs, etc. So the real calls up for Jews became much later, and in the meantime, it was not that it was a big collection of people who were in the resistance because of this uprising. Now, the uprising was a one and only a thing, and it didn't succeed. It didn't have any success. There was an uprising in the whole of the Netherlands in April 1943, 2 years later, everywhere in the Netherlands, but not in Amsterdam, because they had seen what the Germans could do, just killing at random. And people in other parts of the Netherlands were not afraid because they hadn't seen that. they hadn't experienced that the how the Germans really reacted when they found out that the people were against them. So now there are a lot of reasons why more Jews were killed in France and in the Netherlands and in France and Belgium. I can try to explain a few points. In the Netherlands, Jews were welcome since the 17th century. They were secondary citizens, but Roman Catholics were also second-hand citizens in Calvinist country like the Netherlands. That changed after Napoleon in 1812, I think. Jews became more part of Dutch society. But what is more, Jews felt themselves part of society, and they were not afraid of the government. The government was their government. And when you go to France, it was quite normal that you didn't trust the government and you were cheating with the taxes, etc. Because those people in Paris, who was government, those were terrible people. The same in Belgium. But not in the Netherlands. Here in the Netherlands, we had a very nice government. People didn't cheat the taxes, etc. You did trust your government. And when you look at Belgium, there in the 1920s, a lot of Jews came from Poland as they worked in the mines, etc. And they had two very important things in their head. The government is terrible. In Poland, the government is anti-Semite. Don't trust the government. And they had a strong trade unionism. So they didn't trust the government in Poland and they didn't trust it in Belgium. So they resisted like they always did against the government. And in the Netherlands, the German occupier said to the highest officials in the departments, okay, we've occupied the Netherlands. Your queen and your government is now in England, so we are running your country, but you can stay the boss, those high officials. Of course, we control you a little bit, but you have to do what we are telling you to do, but you can do it yourself. So when the first anti-Jewish measures came, it were not the Germans who asked Jews to come to the Jews were asked to show themselves up to get a G from Jood, from Jew, in their identification papers. They didn't were asked by the Germans to go to a German soldiers' barrack or something. No, they had to go to their own town hall, and they did it. 99% did it. Because they trusted the government. And it's very good to trust your government in peacetime, but trust your government in times of war can be lethal. Secondly, if you want to escape the Netherlands, you can go to Switzerland or Spain. You have to cross three or four countries. If you want to go to England over sea, the North Sea is very, very dangerous, rough sea. You cannot do that in a small boat or whatever. We don't have big spaces where you can hide. We are a very densely populated country. So it all together gives more. And all those factors are, you cannot say there is one factor most important, but I think one of the most important factors is trust in your government, even if your government is infested with Germans. And also on very low level, the Dutch officials, the civil servants, did whatever they had to do because their bosses were doing that too. If the bosses would have said, "Okay, we quit," then you can think that the lower civil servants say, "Oh yeah, if my boss quit, I quit too." But if he goes on and say, "Yeah, I have to do it, you have to do it too," then you have this terrible. There has been now a book has been published about civil servants in Amsterdam during wartime. And that is devastating. Those people are not anti-Semites, but the order comes from above and you have to behave. And you don't say no. well, you don't say no. You never say no. And if you try to say no, they say, oh, yeah, then maybe they'll put me in prison, or I have no work anymore. I have wife and kids, etc. You can see that the most people in the resistance were younger people without a family or children. Obvious that very often a lot of students, yeah, they didn't have, they don't have to bring money home, etc. But going into resistance when you're married and you have children, that's a big choice.
David, thank you so much for taking time to talk with me today.
I love to do it. And those cases in the back are wine cases, but it's part of my archive. It's not my wine case.
David Barnow has been a researcher and spokesperson at the Dutch Institute for War, Holocaust, and Genocide Studies. He's published several books on the German occupation of the Netherlands. He's a world-renowned specialist on Anne Frank and one of the two editors of the Diaries of Anne Frank, the critical edition. I've been talking with him about his book, The Phenomenon of Anne Frank. If you'd like to listen to my full conversation with David Barnow about the history and memory of the Holocaust in the Netherlands, you can find it by going to the podcast website, realmsofmemory.com, and clicking on the link to the Realms of Memory Patreon site. If you've enjoyed this or other episodes of Realms of Memory, send a link to a friend or family member. Your support makes all the difference. I'm Rick Dedarian. Thanks for listening.